Genesis chapter 5. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day that God created man, in the likeness of God made he him. Male and female created he them. And he blessed them. And he called their name Adam in the day when they were created. We now come to the end of the first section of the book of Genesis. That is, those initial stories and events that deal with creation. The creation of all things generally and the creation of mankind specifically. And now we come to a genealogy which gives us the family tree, if you would, of the godly line of Seth. It starts with Adam, but it follows that line through the godly line of Seth. And it brings us to the next section, which deals with Noah and the flood and the Noahic covenant that we'll be talking about at a later time. So chapter 5 is sort of a bridge, if you would, between the first four chapters and then the next chapters, which deals with Noah and the story of the great flood. I call your attention tonight to this phrase here at the very get-go. This genealogy speaks of that which began with Adam and goes through his son Seth, the godly line, unlike the ungodly family tree that we looked at in our study last week. I found that study personally to be very intriguing. It explains why things are so weird in our culture. It explains why things are the way that they are societally, because we saw what happened through Cain's family. And that was a very dysfunctional family tree. I don't like that phrase, but nonetheless, you know what I'm suggesting. It was a bizarre deal that came through Cain, and we still feel the repercussions to this day. But the godly line of Seth, on the other hand, is going to be talked about and explored in Genesis chapter 5. But this one phrase intrigues me greatly. God created man in his likeness. Male and female created he them and blessed them, and he called their name Adam in the day when they were created. And here we see, gang, retrospectively, the Lord looking back here in verse 1 and 2 of Genesis 5, you see, to that day when God created Adam and then caused Adam to fall into a deep sleep and took a rib from Adam's side, and from that rib he fashioned the woman, and he brought them together, and there in that garden setting, there was the first wedding ceremony. And God himself presided over the first wedding ceremony. God himself was the officiating pastor, if you would. God himself was the one who would make a proclamation telling Adam and Eve that they are now one, man and wife, if you would, brought into this wonderful miracle, this marvelous mystery of matrimony. And I say this because you're going to talk to people occasionally that say, hey, what's the big deal about having a wedding ceremony? And they'll say things like this, and you will hear it at some time if you haven't already. Where do you see wedding ceremonies talked about in the scripture specifically? There's no need for a formal ceremony. You just choose a woman and you move in with her and you be true to her and hey, you're married in God's eyes, and what's the big deal? You don't need a marriage ceremony. You don't need a wedding certificate. You don't need an officiating minister. You can just go out in the woods and hold hands or hug a redwood tree and you know, affirm your love and quote Shakespeare and say a verse and offer a prayer and you're married, you see. What's the big deal about a marriage ceremony? You don't need a ceremony. You just choose your partner and you commit yourself to each other and you become one together intimately and you're married. And believe me, there are people, even in our valley right now, who claim to be Christians, who really believe that. That there's no need, biblically, scripturally, for a marriage ceremony. And the idea that they say of an institutionalized form called matrimony in the way that we do it traditionally is not biblical. There's no need for that. Well, I challenge that premise and I disagree with it vehemently, strongly. Because if you go out and you stand by a redwood tree and you hug it and you quote your poetry and you commit yourself to your baby and she commits herself to you, and then you just go off and say, well, we're married in the eyes of God and we didn't have to have any other people there or any ceremony to work through. I have discovered that it's very, very, very easy, too easy, to say after a year or two or three or four, well, I don't think we're married anymore in God's eyes. And you just move out and split up. And those people that choose to go that route of just sort of quoting their feelings to each other and sitting, you know, in a grassy field under the stars and, you know, whatever. I think that they are in error as far as it relates to the biblical pattern. And I say that because here in the first mention of a wedding, it says God was presiding over that ceremony and God pronounced them, proclaimed that they were man and wife. He called their name Adam. The idea there is proclamation, declaration. He called their name Adam, you see. And I suggest to you, secondly, for your consideration, not only do we see that in the first mention of marriage, if you would, a ceremony here in Genesis 5, where it says God presided and proclaimed in declaring their name to be Adam, but Jesus, the first miracle that he ever did was at a marriage ceremony. He was there. And in so going to the ceremony and choosing to do his first miracle at the ceremony, Jesus was very definitely putting his seal of approval on the ceremony. It was a formal wedding ceremony. Now, I'm not talking about formal in the sense of tuxedo and tails and top hat and all that. I'm saying that it was a real ceremony with a presiding official, with friends and family witnessing the vows and a part of the process, you see. And Jesus was there, and Jesus, you know the story, most of you, turned water into wine at the marriage ceremony because they were out of wine. Wine is a symbol of joy. And things were looking kind of bad there, you see. And Jesus was at the ceremony and did his glorious first miracle there at Cana. So all that's to say, when you look at the Father here in Genesis 5, presiding over the first marriage ceremony and declaring their name to be Adam. And then in the New Testament, you see Jesus, the Son, doing his first miracle at a marriage ceremony. I cannot help but conclude that marriage ceremonies, that is a man and a woman standing in the presence of God before a representative of God, that is really the right way. Where it is official, where it is legitimized. It's not just two people under the stars or in a meadow, but rather there is really something happening publicly, officially, and I suggest that it's important for anyone who wants to really do things in the best way. Now, it says here that God looked at them and proclaimed their name is Adam. Did you catch that? God looked at them and declared their name, proclaimed their name, pronounced their name to be Adam. It was not Adam and Eve hyphen Adam. It was not Adam and Eve Hillary Adam. There was no maiden name. There was a letting go of the previous identity to merge into a new union of solidarity and singularity. This really amazes me. God looked at them, Adam and Eve, and he pronounced there in that wedding ceremony, in that garden setting. He said, their name is not Mr. and Mrs. Adam and Eve. Not Adam and Eve hyphen Adam. Not the Adams family. He just looked at them and he said, their name is Adam. Which speaks of the mystery and the miracle and the marvel of marriage. There is a oneness. There is a unity. Which, yes, that oneness and unity is testified at and celebrated during the marriage ceremony. But you see, it's more than that. Yes, a marriage ceremony is, I believe, right in the sight of the Lord. Yes, a marriage ceremony is, I believe, in harmony with the pattern of true biblical matrimony. Yes. But it's much more than that. For you see, God would say to the man, to the woman, that the two would become one flesh. That they would leave every other and cleave to each other. And that speaks of the intimacy that takes place in sexual union. Yes, there is a legal, a spiritual coming together in the ceremony, but then there is this oneness that happens as the result of the mystery and beauty of a man and a woman becoming one sexually. Now, here's the deal. I know what I'm about to say here is, in a sense, preaching to the choir. I know you guys already know these things. But you know what I'm asking for tonight? I'm asking for this to be, in a sense, a choir rehearsal. I'm asking that the choir might sing more loudly in the community in which we live, in the culture which we're a part of, because people don't understand. People believe that when two, a man and a woman, come together sexually, when they have intercourse with each other, that it's two bodies, two experiences, coming together physically, sensually, romantically, whatever. It is that. But it's much, 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 much more than that. And our kids on the campuses and our culture as a whole is so confused, folks. our kids are being taught that, hey, sexuality is an experience that's part of your innate personhood that must be expressed, but it must be done in a safe manner with certain precautions and certain considerations, lest you become pregnant or lest you contract disease. The Bible doesn't speak in those terms. The Bible doesn't deal with the issue of sexuality and intimacy as a way to avoid unwanted pregnancy or to keep yourself from disease physiologically. The Bible deals with sexuality in the terms of two people, Adam and Eve, becoming one. Two souls, two spirits becoming one in this mystery of intimacy in marriage. It is not just two bodies. It is not simply emotional unity. It is the deepest part of you, the essence, the eternal part of you that joins with another in the act of marriage and you become one. God looks on that situation and says, their name is Adam, singular. There is something that happens that we, I believe, don't fully comprehend. And when such activity takes place outside of marriage, it is also just as powerful, just as miraculous in a negative way. When such activity takes place outside of the sanctity of marriage, when there is involvement in what the scripture calls adultery, just like when two come together in intimacy in marriage and God declares there's a mystery, a marvel, a miracle, their name is Adam, they're one in essence. So too, when you are involved, when one is involved outside of marriage, that same power kicks in only in a destructive manner. And as I've mentioned in previous studies, that's why the book of Proverbs says, he that commits adultery is unwise. He destroys his own soul. Doesn't say he might get a disease or she might become pregnant. No, doesn't even address those issues, as real as those things are. It says if there's adultery involved, just like the beauty and potency in marriage causes there to be unity and oneness, so too outside of marriage, it brings about destruction and erosion. So much so that Jesus, our Lord, draws from this passage, this story. And in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus uses this setting, this vignette. He uses this particular understanding of the two in the Garden of Eden being brought together by God, becoming one with each other, and God proclaiming their name is Adam. Jesus says this about that when he was asked about divorce. Some interesting things he had to say using this text as the basis of his discussion. They came to him that day, tempting him in verse 3 of Matthew 19. And they said, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? There was a debate in Jesus' day about divorce. Two schools of thought, each headed by a mega rabbi, a superstar of Judaism. Hillel, a very intelligent, learned rabbi, was liberal. And what he was teaching his disciples and his line of thinking was this. In the law of Moses, it says that if there is uncleanness found in your spouse, in your wife, that that would be reason for divorce. And he and his followers interpreted uncleanness in a very broad way. For example, if you saw a cleaner woman on the street, that would make your wife unclean in comparison. If your wife, and there really is rabbinical teaching that's written along these lines, if your wife put too much spice on your food and it caused you to lose your temper and in a burst of anger utter a profanity, well, she made you sin by over salting or over peppering your eggs or whatever, and consequently there's uncleanness that has resulted because of her not cooking properly, and that could be grounds for divorce. Truly, there's really rabbinical teaching along the lines of, if your wife can't cook and do things right and that makes you lose your temper, well, she's got to go. You see. And there's a whole school of thought in Jesus' day that was saying that, and consequently, divorce was rampant. And all you would have to do was look at your wife and say, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, three times. And then you would be divorced according to that school of thought. On the other side of the coin, you had Shammai. He was conservative, and his followers and disciples were taught and propagated this line of thinking that divorce would never be allowed for any reason whatsoever. And so this debate was raging in the Jewish community at the time when Christ was beginning his ministry and teaching. And they came to him, tempting him, verse 3, that is, wanting to get him sucked into this controversy about divorce. And he answered them and said, verse 4, have you not read that he which made them at the beginning, that's the Father, he made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh? Wherefore, Jesus said, they are no more two, but they are one flesh. They're no longer two individuals, but because they have cleaved to each other, they are now one with each other. And what God has joined together, Jesus said, let not man put asunder. Well, they said, verse 7, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? Why is it in the law at all, this whole idea of divorce? Why did Moses write this stuff? What are you going to do with that, Rabbi? They said to Jesus that day. Jesus said, verse 8, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, allowed you to put away your wives. It's because your hearts were so hard, so calloused, that Moses suffered it, allowed it, legislated it. The law makes provision for it, not because that's God's desire, that's God's plan or God's intent, but because of the hardness and callousness of men's hearts. Moses allowed it. Notice Jesus doesn't even say God ordered it. He says Moses allowed it. But from the beginning, it was not so. I say to you, verse 9, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication. Whoever puts away his wife, except it be for fornication, and marries another, commits adultery. And whosoever marrieth her, which is put away, doth commit adultery. Now, Jesus is getting right into the fray of this controversy, and he says, listen, you've got it all wrong. You need to not refer back to Moses. You need to go back further to the Garden of Eden and understand what God desires and declared when he said they are not two, but one flesh. Their name is what? Adam. And Jesus said, there's no reason for divorce. There's no biblical, justifiable reason for divorce except, he said, for the case of fornication, adultery. Same word. What's Jesus saying to you and me? It means that Jesus is saying, God never desired for divorce to be part of the equation in any culture, in any society. But there is one exception. And that exception is if there is adultery. Now, Jesus didn't say you must divorce if there's adultery. But Jesus did say the reality of the situation is it will very, very possibly demand or require divorce. There is such a power in this idea of intimacy and sexuality. Such a spiritual force kicks in. So potent is it that Jesus in Matthew 19, referring back to the story of our text, throws light on the issue and says, divorce, not an option. Put it out of your vocabulary. Not even a thing you should be talking about, except, Jesus said, if there's adultery. But I'm sorry, she said to me. I'm really sorry that I did that. And she shared the things that she felt caused her to be forced into that position or vulnerable to that situation or pushed into the arms of that other man. I'm sorry. And she was. So why can't it just be forgiven? God forgives me. Why can't we just go on? And this is where, choir, I need you to sing loudly. I told her, yes, God does forgive you. Instantly, totally, thoroughly, completely, you are forgiven. When Jesus hung on that cross, he took that very sin of your adultery and he died for it, and the blood that he shed washes it away completely, so thoroughly that it doesn't even come into the mind of the Father. He doesn't even remember as far as the east is from the west. That's how far that sin is. It's put behind his back, the prophet tells us. It's buried in the sea, the prophet speaks to you and me. The sin is forgiven, forgotten. It's not remembered anymore. But here's the problem. Sex is so powerful. Not just emotionally, not just physically, but spiritually and soulically. That it is the singular thing that our Lord said can put a bullet in the head of that marriage and kill it. And if it's dead, there's two possibilities. Adultery kills. It plain old, flat out kills. The mystery of two becoming one, beautiful. So too in adultery, they're ripped apart just as powerfully in one act of sex, of intercourse outside of marriage. There is a ripping. There is a destroying. And this is what people are confused about. They say, but John, you've been teaching us that sin is sin, whether it's gossip or whether it's a lousy attitude or lying or whatever it might be, that sin is sin. Is that not so? Yes. God doesn't rank sins, folks. Some church traditions do. Maybe you came from a church that had mortal sins and venial sins and not so bad sins. God doesn't look at it that way. All sin is equivalent. It's all equally hideous in the sight of our Father. But, listen, but not all sins carry the same repercussion. This is the problem. Paul said, don't be deceived. He said, God is not mocked. In other words, there's no exception to this. You can't mock this fact. Whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. If I have Tambo sitting up here on this stool beside me, and I pull a revolver out of my pocket, and I put it to her temple, and I pull the trigger, she falls down dead, and I can be real sorry about that. And I can say, I just lost my head for a moment. I'm really sorry. I had a hard day today, and I was with Rick Vesney, and I just had a hard time, and I lost my stability, and I my diet has been not right, I'm sorry. I didn't really mean that. I'm sorry. I can be sorry, but my wife is on the floor dead because of one act of firing a single bullet into her head. And I can cry and weep before God, and God forgives me. He does. As amazing as that may be, God forgives me. But my marriage is over. Do you understand that? It's over. I'm sorry. I was pushed into it by circumstances, I feel, and I feel real bad, but my marriage is over. That's the repercussion. The sin, yes, forgiven. Even, amazing as this may be, forgotten. But God says, you need to understand something. If you sow seeds of destruction, you'll reap a harvest of destruction, and no one gets around that. My marriage is gone. I feel awful. That's the way it is. Unless God chooses to do a miracle. And Tammy is resurrected from the dead. And I go, awesome. But a miracle, by its very definition, is a rare, rare, rare exception. I would not encourage anyone to shoot your spouse and count on there being a bodily resurrection. You would be most foolish. Oh, it could happen. I'm not denying the possibility of a miracle. But you would not be wise to assume that there's a good possibility that a miracle will happen if I put that bullet in hubby's head or wifey's temple. It's probably not going to be. There's death. And the Lord here is saying, here's the fact. Divorce, don't even use the word. Don't even think about that. However, he says, there is an issue that truly can cause there to be the need to bury the dead relationship. And that's what divorce is. Well, then you say, if that's the case, okay, we get divorced and I move on. You don't move on. That's the problem. See, we have this crazy vulnerability in our depraved, fallen condition. We always think that the grass is greener on the other side of the hill. It's not. And if it is, it's probably because there's a septic tank underneath that patch of grass. I'm amazed by what I call a used car mentality that we're all sucked into. At least I am. Ever hang out at a used car lot? It's amazing what happens. I bought some used cars. Bought one recently. I took in the car that I was selling to the car lot. And here's my thing. Man, I'm getting rid of that lemon. And then I see the car on the lot that I'm going to buy. Before I even finished signing the papers on that car that I was getting rid of, another couple came and bought it. Before the papers were even, true story, you can ask Tambo, before the papers were even signed, another couple came in and bought it. And it hit us. This is crazy. Used car, it's, people go in and say, got rid of that dump. And somebody else comes and says, wow, my dream come true. And it's a perpetual trading. And I bought a car that somebody said, boy, I'm glad I got rid of that bug. And I bought it. And it's really bizarre. The whole car thing illustrates powerfully our vulnerability. We think, man, that car that person just dumped. And they're saying that car that person just dumped. And it's this merry-go-round of trading cars that goes on and on. Millions of cars are sold each week in our country. Just people trading cars. And people do the same thing relationally. And here's what they don't understand. The person that you're married to, even if you married that person without seeking God's will or guidance or direction, the person that you are married to, even if they were number 5,000 on the list, there was 4,999 ahead of her or him that would have been more suited for you. But once you say, I do, it's my strong conviction that God, knowing our used car mentality of trading to try and get a sleeker car and a faster, more powerful engine and a cushier interior, God knows that. And so even if the person that you picked and have committed to was number 5,000 on the list, once you say, I do, that person becomes number one. What? Yep. No one is going to make you happier. But I'm not happy with him. I'm not happy with her. Then you're not happy. You're going to take the same unhappiness, the same murmuring kind of spirit, the same complaining and sadness. You're going to take that same package into the next situation. No matter if he or she might be a newer model and have a sleeker engine and a cushier interior, you see. You're taking the same unhappiness. There's a dynamic at work here. That is, God says, knowing our nature, I believe the heart of God and part of the miracle of the mystery of matrimony is this. Okay, once you say I do, that's it. No one is going to make you happier. Even if that wasn't my best for you initially, now he is, or now she is. Until death separates you, or unless there be the sin of fornication and adultery that causes there to be a death. And The relationship has to be buried, and you are not the party that is guilty. Now, if one understands this, you look at your husband and you look at your wife and you say, this is it. There's not another one around the corner, over the hill, or down the line that's going to give me a greater thrill. There's not another one who's going to make me happier, more content, more fulfilled. You see, that is impossible. For this cause shall a man leave all others, cleave to his wife, the two shall be one, and let no man put it asunder. No man think that there is another possibility that would do more for me. No. Once one says, I do, that's it. And this is what we see happening. People are saying, I don't believe that. I believe I could be happier with him or with her. And we have a valley full, a state full, a nation full, a world full of people that trade partner after partner, and they remain in their misery. And then here's what happens. As the years go on, their hearts are broken. Listen, nothing is worth the loss of your family. Nothing. There are couples in our church that weren't perfectly matched, body, soul, and spirit. But they stayed together because they understood the way of the Lord, the highway of holiness. And I've watched them now because I've been here for 20 years. And I've watched the hair turn gray or fall out. And I've watched the back bow a bit. And I know of couples that I could name specifically who in their early years and even middle-aged years went through some very difficult and trying times. And now, they look at their grandchildren. And they look at their family. And they say, wow, it's worth it to go God's way. Sitting in my study a couple days ago, I was doing some correspondence and the speaker was on. And I heard something come over the speaker and I thought, my, they're playing one of my tapes and it's not the right time for Searchlight to be on. And I was sitting there doing some work and I listened and cocked my ear a bit. And I realized, that's not me. That's my boy, Peter John. And I didn't know that he was going to be calling from Vanuatu to be on the air with Andy on Andy's missions program. And I walked into the studio and grabbed the microphone and pushed Andy aside. I'm bigger than he is. And I got behind the mic and I began to talk to Peter and interviewed him for the next half hour or so. And I don't know if you had a chance to hear that interview, but man, you know, my son, he's 21. And he is mature. I mean, the way he sounded and the things he said. And he is teaching along with some of the other young brothers who have such a heart. And I left that interview and I was just smiling from ear to ear. My heart was just turning somersaults inside. You know why? Because Peter John, and I say this from the bottom of my being, I suppose more than any other teacher around today that I'm exposed to or linked with, Peter John ministers to my heart with his insights from the Word and truths that just really teach me and touch me. Now, that may not mean anything to you, but let me tell you what it means to me. To be taught by your eldest son and to watch him walk in truth. There's nothing that is more exciting or more thrilling or more elating. I totally agree with the Apostle John. In 3 John verse 4, John says, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. There's nothing like it. And I see people throw that possibility away because they're going for a newer model or a sleeker interior or a faster engine. And they become, in their elderly years that come oh so quickly, they become bitter and saddened and lonely. And it just ought not to be. My daughter Christy, studying, preparing, planning on being a missionary, if the Lord opens that door, walking with God. As she always does, as I drove her up tonight, just saying, Dad, let me pray for you and laying hands on me and praying for me. I wouldn't miss that for the world. And Mary and Ben, both of their teachers this week, both of their teachers at Jacksonville Elementary said, these kids just talk about Jesus all the time. Two different classes, two different teachers. And both teachers commented that our kids, they talk about the Lord a lot. It is so thrilling. It is so satisfying to hear and watch and see kids. And I am so looking forward to that next season in life. Being a grandpa. I really am really looking forward to that. And watching that generation, should the Lord tarry, grow up, walking in truth. There's no greater joy. And that is jeopardized and trashed and thrown away in many, many, many cases because a man or a woman says, well, if I have intercourse with her, I'll be forgiven. Yes, you're forgiven. Boom! And the family is dead. But grace, sure there's grace. Bang! But the repercussions, be not deceived. God is not mocked. What a man sows, he's going to reap. There's this thing called sex and intimacy that is powerful in the spirit. It can cause unity and oneness. It can equally cause destruction and tragedy and the death of a family. Don't lose your family. Whatever seductress is pulling on you, be it some guy who's seemingly oh so spiritual. Why isn't my hubby that way? Well, I'll just pray with him, share with him. Or whether it's some woman who seems to just do it for you. Whatever it might be. It's not worth it to lose your family. Whether it be the temptress of a career. Well, we can just get that second house or that faster boat if I just work extra long hours. And honey, if you would take on a little more hours too on the job, we could really get ahead. what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses the soul? And I suggest to you the soul of your son or your daughter, your family. It's not worth it. There's no greater joy than seeing, as life goes on, your family raised up and walking in truth. And there's no deeper sorrow than seeing the loss of family. I've watched my kids, and I miss my daughter greatly. I miss my daughter profoundly, in ways that it's not necessary or needful to express to others. But I don't think there's a day that's gone by in the past now almost 2 years where I haven't thought about Jessie. I miss her greatly. I know where she is. I'm thankful that she is in heaven, because, man, she's in a better place. Of that I am certain. No question. I'm telling you this tonight because I have seen the joy of watching kids grow up and family work out. And I have also felt the incredible pain of losing family. Nothing is worth losing your family over. No one, nothing. And if one chooses to go in a carnal way and say, well, I'm forgiven, yes, you will be, but there's going to be repercussions, absolutely. Let nothing destroy your family. Let nothing cause there to be a loss in the family. In my case, my daughter is ensconced. She's safely tucked in. She is in heaven. She was a lover of Jesus, and she is presently, I guarantee that. But the ache that is in my heart and the things that I deal with, I know that that is not comparable to the ache that some people feel over the loss of their sons and daughters. Oh, not physically, not moving on into their eternal destiny, but sons and daughters who just aren't walking with God, not interested in God because of the death of a marriage. Because of not seeing reality in the home. Because of an anger at mom and dad who chose to part company and pursue some other. That's a loss that would be excruciating. Nothing is worth losing your family over. I don't know again tonight who I am addressing. As I said in my opening comment, I know I'm preaching to the choir. I need the choir to sing louder. Talk to your sons, your daughters, your friends, your relatives. It's not worth it. The moment of so-called pleasure, the titillation, the fascination, the fantasy, or the career, the ministry, whatever it might be that is causing there to be a loss of family, it's not worth it. There's no greater joy than to see your kids walk in truth. And the way that that will happen most successfully is if mom and dad choose to stay together and not kill the relationship through sexual indiscretion, through adultery. Keep your family intact. Don't even open the door a crack for anything of sensuality to begin to erode your morals in a way that would lead to the very real possibility of adultery, which can put a bullet in the head of your family. It's not worth it. And you really don't know what you have until you don't have it. Women, I don't care how unromantic your hubby may be, or how spiritual that other fellow may seem to you currently. It's not worth it. You stay with your husband. You stand by your man. You choose to love him. You don't open the door, even in fantasy, even in romance novels, even in women's television network. You just don't go there. You say, I'm not going to do that. Because that's opening the door a crack for the possibility of thoughts coming into my head that will work out in temptations that are sent my way, that would put a bullet in the head of my family. And what then? When I'm older and gray, what then? What then? What then? What do I have? For some stupid, fleeting pleasure that I was pursuing. And fellas, you might think that you're just a hunk of burning love. You might think that you may say, well, I just am too much man for any one woman, you know. You may fashion yourself as super stud, you know, and swagger around and say, man, I just got to have my, you know. Did you hear the news 2 days ago? True, absolutely true story. I was just rolling laughing. There's a doctor in Memphis, Tennessee, who in 1958 took a wart off of Elvis Presley and saved the wart. So he's got this wart in this solution that saves it. And you know, Elvis fans, there's a movement amongst Elvis fans. They call themselves ACE, A-C-E. And it stands for Americans for Cloning Elvis. And they're suing to get this wart from this doctor for the possibility of cloning that wart. And they claim they're serious about this. I can't. Seems to me you're just going to have a great big rock and rolling wart. I don't know, but. and there is that thing in us that thinks that we're Elvis or something or whatever. But understand this. You can lose everything and end up a very sad, sorry person. And your song will not be hunk-a-hunk-a burning love. Your song will be Heartbreak Hotel. And you'll sing the blues to your grave. That's the fact. You'll never find more satisfaction going on the low road of carnality than you will find on the highway of holiness. There is always more satisfaction. Always more. Mick Jagger understands that. He can't get no. And it's really true. It's really so. The highway of holiness and the low road of carnality, this road will always lead to sadness. This road will always lead to happiness ultimately. So, John, why are you saying these things? Because last night I ran into church at 19 after, because I was back in my office finishing up a long day of counseling couples. Good people. Good people. Good brothers and sisters. Who thought that fornication, adultery would be forgiven. What's the problem? And now, devastated. At a time when they're just on the verge of enjoying grandkids. Thrown away. Lost. Wiped out. Because they didn't understand the difference between being forgiven, and they are, versus the inevitable repercussions. God talks more about the sin of adultery than any other single sin. And it's not because he goes, ooh, I just can't stand. It's he's saying, this sin uniquely brings about real long-term problems and real sad repercussions. And I guess after last night coming in, I was going to go through truly. I told Tambo, I said, honey, I had was home for 38 minutes yesterday and grabbed a shower and grabbed a piece of chicken and said, honey, I'm doing five tonight, guarantee, five chapters. And I got to this verse because, see, I didn't know that I was going to be dealing again with these issues right before study and all that stuff. And you know, forgive me, but I and I know you do, I really feel that I need, as your brother and perhaps your friend, I need to just be a pastor tonight and say, don't do it. Don't go there. Flee. Don't let anything jeopardize your family. And the thing that will jeopardize your family more than anything else is sexual immorality. Don't go there. It's the one thing that our Lord said, yep, that can definitely deal a death blow to a family. That's the one thing that is reason for divorce. Anything else can be worked out. Anything else can be worked through. But sad to say, Jesus taught that day, that's the one thing that may be unsolvable because of the power of intercourse and spiritual components in the act of marriage, of being intimate. Teach your kids that. Remind each other of that. And decide right now, nothing is going to destroy my family. I'm not going to let it happen. It's not going to be. And if you have been one of the fortunate few who has experienced resurrection miraculously, where there has been adultery, and God has allowed there to be the miracle of resurrection, that is a statistical improbability. I know, I've pastored for 20 years. I've dealt with far, far too many couples. And if God has been good to you and allowed there to be the miracle of resurrection, treasure that. You've been graced. And go your way and sin no more. Never again. And if you've been divorced, you know what I'm talking about. You understand. And now what you get to do, what you've got to do, is say, Lord, I have learned the hard way. I've learned my lessons. I know the crop has got to come up. I know the repercussions are inevitable. But Lord, I give it to you. And the Lord has a way of restoring the years the locust has eaten. But you need to understand the repercussions that go on will always be there. If you are an innocent party, abandoned by your wife or your husband, or where they were the party of fornication and adultery, and the marriage was killed, and you didn't want that to happen, and it just couldn't work because the damage was so severe, God understands that. Paul would say in the Corinthian epistle that in cases like that where he was addressing particularly abandonment, but it would include all of the above, he said a brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. God knows. God knows. But please, precious people, decide tonight, no matter where you've been, no matter what you've been through, nothing is worth the loss of family. And you will do whatever it takes to guard the sanctity of your family. You'll have no greater joy than to watch your family walk in truth. And you'll have no greater heartache than to lose family. Choose wisely. And God looked at them. And God blessed them. And God called their name Adam. They're one. Till death separates you, the one you're sitting by is the one for you. Him? Yep. Her? Uh-huh. But we were mismatched. So, he or she is numero uno from here on out. There is no one else. It's the one you're sitting next to. And if I could encourage you, oh, hubby, put your arm around her before the night is over and say, you're the one. I love you. And wifey, well, do what you can do. And life goes fast. Those of you like me that have a little gray in your hair or in your beard, you know it goes so fast. It goes really, you that are young, you're saying, oh, I'm not the old that goes so fast, rap again. John, it goes fast, eh? Does it not? It goes fast. It goes real quick. Walt, goes fast. It goes fast. It's those kids and those grandkids. That's the key. It's not chasing after some foolish fantasy or some career elevation. It's those kids and grandkids. It's family. It's family. Oh, may God give us wisdom. And I want to thank you for indulging your pastor. I know this might be a bit rambling this evening, but I know that for a couple of people in here, maybe more, these things need to be heard and thought through. Be so careful. Like we sing with Ben and Mary. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. Because there's a Father up above and He's looking down in love. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. Be careful, little ears, what you hear. Be careful, little ears, what you hear. Because there's a Father up above, and He's looking down in love. So be careful, little ears, what you hear. Be careful, little feet, where you go. Be careful, little feet, where you go.
There's a Father up above, and He's looking down in love. So be careful, little feet, where you go. Be real careful, little hands, what you do. Be careful, little hands, what you do. Because there's a Father up above, and He's looking down in love. So be careful, little hands, what you do. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that will he reap. So be oh so careful. Be oh so careful. And take the highway of holiness, which leads to happiness. In the name of Jesus.